Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is a podcast from The Times, sports newspaper of the year.
Hello and welcome to The Game, a snowplow through the slush of football opinion. And no, I don't write my own intros. Joining me in their snow boots this week are Julian Lawrence and Clive Petty. Now, I'm sure many of you out there are wondering who Clive Petty is and why he's on. Clive, you are the...
Assistant sports editor.
The assistant sports editor of the Times Sports Pages. So now you know. Coming up, we'll be discussing Adkins, AFCON, and Arsenal. But let's start at our producer's favorite place, White Hart Lane. Clive, obviously, it was a snowstorm out there. Looked it on TV. Now you were sure this game wasn't going to go ahead.
Looking at the pictures of those poor groundsmen with the ridiculous booms, and it was just like some sort of torture they were making them do. Let's, you know, waltz up and down one side of the pitch, and then we'll turn around, and the snow's back again because it's still falling. I just thought, what did you do to deserve that punishment? I was convinced it was going to be called off, but at the same time, never underestimate the power of Fergie for getting a match put on. He was doing his best in the middle of the pitch there.
Julian, let's go all foreign on these Anglos for a second, because it's weird. This is a country where, a football match in general can get called off for the weirdest situations. In France this year in Marseille, a football game was called off because of wind, very dangerous winds. A couple years ago, you had, I think it was a West Ham game that was called off because it was very cold and icy outside the ground. I mean, it was snowing or anything, which I didn't quite understand. I thought that, people had grit and stuff like that that you could put on the streets. I thought that had been invented a couple centuries ago. But here, you had snow, and it didn't look that bad. As a football lover, does snow necessarily ruin the spectacle? Does it make it worse than, say, driving rain or extreme heat?
The good thing on White Hart Lane is that the press box is so close to the pitch that you could see actually the players so closely. And at some point, the first half, I remember Patrice Evra running with his eyes like he seems really struggling to see, while running towards against the snow. And I'm not sure it was the best conditions, but the pitch was perfect. Fair play to the ground staff, and the players seemed to be okay. So
onto the game itself. I just want to get this out of the way because I think we're just kind of taking for granted now. But I thought the first half hour, Robin van Persie was exceptional. Again, I'm assuming he's already won all the Footballer of the Year awards this year in England. Yeah,
definitely. No doubt. Everything he did was just spot on. The movement, the controls, the passes, the goal. Everything he did in maybe up to the 70th minute, except when he was offside, that way he shouldn't have been offside. It was quite easy, I think, for him not to be offside on that cross from Rafael in the second half on one of the counter attacks. But apart from that, everything he does is just so perfect. I think it's incredible.
Julian, United started well. Did they kind of lose the plot, or was it just the Spurs kicked it up a bunch of notches and we should really be crediting Spurs more than wondering why United lost it a bit?
Well, I don't know. I think Spurs deserve credit, but I do think as well that United stopped playing, and I think they were very happy to sit back and just control, try to control the game, and that the lead they had through Van Persie. And I think when you've got a player like Van Persie in that form, you should play more for him than what they've done yesterday. You know, he had one chance, scored one goal. It was so clinical. I will come back to that cross from Rafael where he was offside, should have been offside. But anyway, give him another chance, he would have scored again, and another chance, he would have probably scored again. Why did they stop playing, you know, and not play more for him like they should have done? Because, you know, Carrick has a great relationship with Van Persie. Surely he could have tried to give him the ball better, cleverly as well. And I just don't know. Kagawa, I think, is very complimentary with Van Persie, but they seem to have stopped playing. You know, once he scored, he hardly had any service after that, which I really struggle to understand.
Is it as simple as that, Clive? It's United stopped playing? Or is it Spurs did something different or better?
I think it was one of the hardest working Tottenham performances I've seen for a long time. I mean, everybody engaged into trying to get something out of this game. United did seem to put a lot more effort into trying to stop the dangers from Spurs than I would usually give them credit for. And usually, as you say, United would be the team, they would just carry on taking the game to them, because that's the, you know, to stop the other team having the ball and stop them playing is what United, you know, gives them their chances. And they did seem to then after a while think, well, we're one up, we're doing okay, and as you say, we've got the outlet of Van Persie, who can, you know, score at will perhaps. Let's just make sure that Bale and Lennon, especially Bale, I mean, you know, Carrick had a great game, but you know, they were always helping out Raphael. Carrick would double up on him, Kagawa would even trap back, and Jones exactly. And a lot of effort went into trying to stop Tottenham, Julian's right. If they'd have carried on, perhaps trying to find a path to Van Persie, Spurs, that work rate would have been negated somewhat.
Let's throw forward, because in the second half, a lot of it was David De Gea making some phenomenal saves, I thought, and really keeping United in the lead until that mistake late in the game, when he sort of really cleared the ball well with his punch, and Clint Dempsey gets that late equalizer, a deserved equalizer in my opinion. What's your take on De Gea Jr.? Because I kind of get the sense that, so he arrives, he's the second most expensive goalkeeper in history, so young, has his ups and downs, but I kind of think like the last sort of 6 weeks or so, he's sort of settled, and having invested so much money into somebody so young, you kind of need to see it out. Instead, we're already hearing rumors that, you know, they might be moving in another direction in terms of goalkeepers. Well, what's your, should they stick with De Gea?
I agree with you. I think he's done well this season, really well. And I disagree with people who said that he made a mistake on the goal. I think Evra is probably,
oh,
in
but
my
he
opinion,
punched goalkeeper punching away. That's something wussy foreign goalkeepers do, like your friends Lloris and Barthez.
Yeah,
people like that. Real goalkeeping men try to catch all the time, and then they do the semen and they drop it all over. So, but it's okay because he didn't punch.
That's true. And I don't know, Evra had no reason to leave Lennon on his own and go to do I don't know what, like helping Vidic jumping over Kolker, or I don't know what he was trying to do, but he left Lennon on his own. The ball got down to Lennon, just crossed it for Dempsey.
So it's Evra's fault. You're just being anti-French again.
No, but in my opinion, Evra is more to blame than De Gea on that one. Definitely.
I don't know about the punching thing. I mean, there were two instances of the goalkeeper punching, and one of them he should definitely have caught when it just looped up and he was in the middle of his own penalty area and punched it away. He could have caught that one.
He didn't punch it far away though, so that was okay.
But I think, and that's what you have to do every time you come for that. And I think that's the problem I have with kind of De Gea, is it's kind of, I mean, he proved during that throughout the match that he was a great shot stopper. But when the crosses came in, that final cross came in, it was a terribly weak punch, and he kind of lacks presence in those situations. You know, proper goalkeepers just come in and it's my ball, clear everybody out of the way and smack it. And it was
making a punching gesture as you do it.
Yeah,
so it's okay for them to punch as long as they shout and say my ball.
You don't have to catch it every time. What you've got to do is make sure it is your ball. You're taking care of this, and everybody knows it. If it's as limp as a soggy lettuce, as Matt Hughes said this morning, it's just going to drop down into the penalty area still. I mean, it's the same with, I think the problem is, it's like, I think we had a discussion before about him and corners, in fact, where we've got kind of Evra standing next to him, stopping attackers standing in front of De Gea, as if he needs that kind of protection. And if you're, you know, if you're a keeper with proper presence and you're controlling your penalty area, then you don't need that.
Yeah, that incidentally, I think we talked about it. I don't know if it was on the show, but I spoke to a Premier League goalkeeper about that. I said that that's really stupid what they do when they put Evra in front of him, because if you just don't have Evra there and you have the striker on De Gea, it's going to be a foul on the goalkeeper every time.
I don't understand it.
Whereas, you know, you can manhandle Evra and, not, and it won't be a foul, but you manhandle the goalkeeper, they'll give it.
So I don't understand it, but there's obviously, I mean, they still do it. I mean, you know, there's still a man standing with their goal, so, you know, a United defender protecting his goalkeeper.
On De Gea, would you stick with him, right? You know, or would you find somebody? What's your take here?
I stick with him. I think it's still a bit too early. I mean, he has shown.
So you wouldn't invest serious money into getting a number one?
They've invested serious money in
no, so De Gea is your man, and now you've got to stick with him.
I think
for another
so. I think you stick with him. You show some confidence in him. I think possibly this talk and this undermining every time it comes up is what's undermining De Gea. You know, they need someone. Someone should just come out and say, look what else he did in the game. Look what he's done. This guy is the international goalkeeper. He will come through. He will be the man.
We had to talk about the incident which so upset Sir Alex. Stephen Caulker on Wayne Rooney. I'm assuming nobody's going to argue that it was not a penalty and that the officials made the right decisions, correct? Okay, good. Because just wondering, since there's a Spurs fan here in the room. So my question here is this, and apparently, I thought it was interesting because I wasn't working last night. I got to see both reactions, and on Sky they said, "Oh, look!" and the referee has a perfect view of it. And then on Match of the Day, there's no way the referee could have seen it. But I guess Fergie sided more with the fact that the assistant should have given it. I mean, we don't call them linesmen; we call them assistant referees for that reason. We get the sense from his body language, and he could have been communicating with the referee, that he simply did not think it was a foul and he didn't see it. It's not that he gave it and it was overruled, right, Clive?
It didn't seem to do anything as far as I could see. Yes, it was basically, let's carry on, the ball's gone out and it's Tottenham's ball. He didn't seem to be saying, no, there's no contact there. Yeah.
That's a pretty big boo-boo, and Sir Alex is correct to be angry and single out the assistant,
yeah.
Julian?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I mean, I think both, to be fair, the assistant and the referee, have in perfect position to see it. And on Match of the Day last night, one of the pundits said that it looked like Rooney is kicking Caulker, which is
Pat Nevin.
Yeah, which is completely rubbish. From where the referee is, how would you see that? It's Rooney kicking Caulker. Yeah, I think it was. But I mean, you know, he was not given. I mean,
Rooney would have taken the penalty anyway and missed. So what the hell? Sure.
There you go. Nothing there from Spurs. So Spurs, I get the sense Villa's boss is doing a fabulous job and whatever else. But then I notice Spurs have 8 fewer points than they did last season. So actually, because these things go in waves, right? So everybody loved Harry. Then everybody hated Harry because, I'm talking about the national media, not Spurs fans, because, you know, you were unsophisticated if you did that. No, Roy Hodgson's the answer. Should we be kind of reevaluating Harry a little bit? And is it fair to make comparisons? I mean, 8 points. I know it's a different season and things are shaping out differently, but
what are you saying? That Spurs aren't, you know, ABB's not as doing as well, or we should reevaluate that? I mean, everyone seems.
My impression from watching Spurs is that they're better this year than they were last year. And they might also be because I wasn't a huge Modric guy and, you know, whatever else, right? But then you look at the numbers and people keep telling me, oh, results are all that matter. They have 8 fewer points this season than they did at the same stage last season. Are they better than last year, even though they have 8 fewer points?
I think they are, yeah. I really think they are, and I think FVB is doing a great job. I think he was spot on in terms of transfers. I think Dembele is a fantastic player. Vertonghen is a great player. Lloris is a very good player. So I think he recruited well. I think he's got them more disciplined, more organised than Harry ever had. he's obviously a much, much better tactician than Harry. There's no doubt about that. And you could see on the
pitch.
And
yet Harry has 8 more points.
Harry has 8 more points, yeah. But I do think that there would never be a collapse with AVB like there was with Harry from March last season and to May. I think that yes, Harry had 8 points more at this stage of the season, but it looks to me a much more solid Tottenham team and squad than it was last year.
I personally definitely agree. I always find it, I think people say winning is all that matter, results are all that matter. I think it's one of the stupidest, idiotic, knee-jerk things that you can say. And and I always cite the fact that the 3 of the 4 greatest World Cup teams in history, Brazil 82, Hungary 54, and Holland 74, didn't actually win the World Cup, and yet we all remember them, and we don't remember the teams who won it, certainly in 54 and 74. Maybe that's probably just because they were German. Moving on to Stamford Bridge, Chelsea and Arsenal. Ooh, refereeing controversy again. This kind of turned a little bit on Chesney, on Ramirez, and there's a basic question about whether Ramirez cheated or whether it was just a penalty or whether it was a penalty or did he just lose his footing? Julian, you're a goalkeeping expert for the day. Did Chesney come out badly and put himself in that situation, or did he do the right thing and actually Ramirez conned the referee?
I think I actually thought straight away that it was not a pen and that Chesney did perfect. He was there in front of Ramirez, didn't commit himself too much forward, and I thought it was just like a ice hockey NHL goalkeeping thing.
Doing the butterfly.
And it was just perfect, I thought. And on the replay, I think you can see that Ramirez loses his footing and actually there's no contact whatsoever.
If he loses his footing, is it a dive? Or is it just one of those things that I think they should call more of, which is a non-call?
Yeah, I don't think he dived. I just think that the way he took the ball on his right foot and went on the right hand side, and with Chesney standing in front, kind of doing the butterfly in front of him, he seems to be slipping, on his right hand side, and I don't think he intended to dive. I just think that it was not a pen, and the game, Jabby got the ball after that, and the game should have kept on.
Yeah, I agree. I can see on first glance why the referee would give a penalty.
It was a much tougher call for the referee.
It certainly was than the Rooney Corker thing. Yeah, definitely. It was much tougher. I mean, the goalkeeper is advancing. The guy is close to his leg. He goes over. But I agree with Julian. On second or even third view of it, I agree. I think his leg does give way, and he does the usual thing as you do as a professional footballer: you appeal for the penalty, and he gets it. But so I don't think there's no booking for a dive, and I suppose he does have to book Chesney under the strict letters of the law. There's never a sending off offence for the goalkeeper. I don't know why people were going on about that. But I think once you get into those realms of you need to see it the second time and the third time, that's where you kind of absolve the referee, because if you get to see it twice, then there's no point in arguing about whether the referee's made a mistake. He just got the one view, and I can quite easily see why he gave a penalty.
Now, there were also, and this went both ways, there was also some annoyance from both sides about players getting injured and referees, or players getting tackled, staying down, referees not giving fouls, and then the other team going up the pitch and scoring. I mean, we saw that with both Arsenal's goal and Chelsea's goal, Chelsea's first goal. I just want to get your take on this because, okay, so back when I was a little boy many, many years ago, you used to put the ball out of play when somebody was injured. Then in England, no, we're not going to do it anymore because, people were abusing it, feigning injury, whatever else. What's your take here then? Is it the kind of thing where once we accept that we're not going to put the ball out of play, then, that's that. Foul doesn't get called, and you just play on, right?
I think it depends on the situation. I don't think yesterday at Chelsea, for example, when Azpilicueta has the ball, I don't think he can put it in the throw-in after the foul from Ramirez on Coughlin. I think in that situation, I think you have to play on. There was a few cases yesterday at White Hart Lane where there's been the same kind of incident, and where the ball was put out, where I think it was more legitimate at the time. But I really think it depends on the situations, and when you get the ball, and if you're on the move forward, or depending where the ball is as well, that you could keep the ball or not. But I think it's a tough one. It's a really, really tough one.
Now, Fernando Torres has a new haircut, Clive. Now, Rory, who I know knows a lot about Rafa Benitez because he read his book, he points out when this matches my information is that in Rafa's mind and in the proprietor's mind, Torres is still the number one striker, although obviously he's being rotated more with Demba Ba. Did you have any novel theory about, I mean, I know he worked harder and so on, and people showed like his acceleration yesterday. We're like, oh, look, he beats Ramal. Yeah, but then he just, you know, hits the ball like 50 yards forward.
It was a terrible second touch.
Any logic? So we can safely rule out that it was the haircut which was making him substandard.
He's tried everything else. He's cut his hair now. He's dyed his hair before that. Didn't seem to work either. No, I don't think it's a style thing with Fernando. I really have run out of ideas about what we do about Fernando.
If Bae had started, would Chelsea have killed the game early on? And we would be happy, because given how poor Arsenal were in the first half.
Given how poor Arsenal were in the first half, yes, most definitely, I think so, yeah. Perhaps it is time to take Torres out of the spotlight for a little while, because Barr is definitely a man in form. Let's give him his run, you know, from the Newcastle time and for the time he's turned up at Stamford Bridge. He looks hungry to succeed. He looks hungry to show what his worth is at the moment. 10 minutes at the end of that game, he was those 10 minutes at the end of Sunday, and he was still more potent looking than Torres had been for the previous 80. So, but
if you're Demba Ba and you've clearly brought more to your team in 10 minutes than Torres in the 80 minutes he played, and then you hear Benitez saying that Torres was a key player in that win, and that people who criticise Torres, you know, don't get it. If you're Demba Ba and you hear that, what are you thinking? Do you know what I mean?
You're thinking I'm a very rich man because I've moved to Chelsea and I'm no longer in Newcastle. And
yeah, no, maybe.
I'm grateful to be here. And it's really good.
You still want to play more than 10 minutes against Arsenal.
You know what? If you're Demba Ba, you also think, well, it's really good that he's sticking with Torres, because that means there's only the two of us here and Torres isn't very good. If he decides to cut Torres loose, he might bring in another striker who's a lot better than me. This way, it's just a matter of time before we win this war of attrition with Torres and start every game, right?
Yeah, or you could also think, well, if you think that Torres was brilliant today, if he scores one in the next game, well, I will never play again. So, well,
why were Arsenal so bad? Is this kind of where we see? I like Arteta as much as the next guy, but I never really thought, you know. I have a friend who's an Arsenal supporter and tells me that, you know, when Arteta's not there, the wheels come off. I kind of got a sense that was the game. Was it Arteta missing, or was it Coughlin and Diaby?
Does Arteta do? Is it an organisation thing, or someone just calling and making sure everybody knows their role? Because I don't think what they're lacking is someone who actually organises some sort of defensive midfield role in it. And I didn't think that was Arteta's. Didn't think that's why they brought him in the first place. Was it? It's not. Because there's...
Well, at least he stands in the right places and he sees the pitch.
Well,
and, you know,
perhaps that's what they're missing.
He has become a leader. There's a bit of that. He has become a leader this season, especially when he plays a bit deeper than before.
He's the deepest of the three most of the time.
Yeah, exactly. You know, he plays in that holding role, although it's not his best position, I think. But
he does like the Pirlo, like, tactical foul and, like, you know, fill the space thing.
Exactly. But I also think that Coquelin is not good enough for that kind of game, that kind of level. I think that Diaby, after missing out for 3 months, you play him three games in 8 days, which is three games in eight days.
What's the logic? Well, you've got this is like the most injury-prone player in the Premier League, and I think we both are big Diaby fans. But why you have to then chuck him in like this? Is there nobody else he could have played?
It's the only reason I see why.
Was Frimpong, was he on the bench yesterday? Yeah. Surely that was, you know, if you're going to start with Diaby, but you've got him on the bench, you know.
Would you ever consider getting slightly more creative and maybe, I don't know, something crazy like...
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Playing Vermaelen in midfield or going three at the back, which is increasingly fashionable, or trying something.
I don't think he's ever... No, I don't think Wenger's ever thought about that. Ever. And I even think that playing Wilshere higher on the pitch is a mistake, because clearly...
Because he messes with Cazorla.
Yeah, and because he doesn't defend enough. And yesterday you saw him, they showed a nice clip on Match of the Day
that
where...
Was the other one. That was hilarious!
I know. And clearly when he is playing a bit deeper... And he's at the heart of everything. He's got much more impact defensively as well. I know it's not all about defending, but clearly yesterday in the first half he was all about defending, and he would have been much more involved and much more useful, I think.
Enough Arsenal, and Rafa Benitez tells us that Chelsea can't win the title. I know, by the way, this is a little 10-second aside from me. People are like slaughtering for saying Chelsea can't win the title. Mancini said that City couldn't win the title last year, and they were much, much closer to the top. So I think that's one situation where we're being a little bit unfair to Rafa. Anyway, moving on to another manager who's no longer. Nigel Adkins had got some decent good results with Southampton, and of course he was replaced by Mauricio Pochettino, who is somebody who I think is going to take people a long time in this country to figure out, because I've heard his name like butchered so many different ways.
Me
but,
too. Yeah.
Now. Familiar story here. Nicola Cortese is a moron. He's trigger happy. Abramovich of the South Coast. Blah blah blah. In fact, our producer Chris even said that many football fans were left with a sick feeling because Adkins was sacked. Now, I don't think Chris is a relative of Nigel Adkins, and he is just expressing his he's shaking his head. There you go. He's not. He's expressing his own genuine heartfelt feelings. Were you left sickened, Clive? Sick to your stomach? Or do you really not care about who manages Southampton?
I don't care that much about who manages Southampton, I have to say. Yeah, they're not.
Okay, so you were not sick. Were you left sickened, Julian?
Not really.
Okay, good. So that's 100% of people on this panel who are not actually... No, just kidding. But, so the narrative here is promoted club, did a good job getting them promoted, had a bumpy start, and then they started getting good results. And since somebody's to play devil's advocate there, I will appoint myself to do so. Clive, if clubs are supposed to take a long view and not sack somebody when they have a run of bad results, right... why can't we give Southampton the benefit of the doubt and say, well, we're taking a long view here. he may have had some decent good results, but we're not going to just going to let that, you know, decide how we evaluate his body of work and whether there's a better option out there. What's wrong with that?
I don't think there's anything wrong with that, assuming that the timing when you actually make that decision, the time you make that decision has to be right too. And I'm not quite sure that, I mean, if you go back into November when they were really were in a terrible run and they decided to stick with Adkins, and the kind of the talk was that we'd give him till the end of the season.
Was the kind of talk from Cortese?
I assume coming out of Cortese, coming out of Southampton. That was the feel of it, because if you didn't get rid of him then, you were going to give this guy a chance. And after giving that guy a chance, Adkins, has to be said, is now in a run where they've only lost two in 12 games. Mm. And you can't say he's lost the terrible phase of, you know, he hasn't lost the dressing room, he hasn't lost the crowd. They're still firmly behind him. Some good results, Aston Villa, draw with Chelsea, but showed great spirit and came back from 2-0 down. I suspect they've got those other teams below them slightly worried. So if you're going to make that decision, perhaps now just seems a very odd time to do it. The long-term decision, bringing in Maurizio, let's go, because I don't know how to say his name either.
Come on, you say it with me, Pochettino.
Pochettino, was that right? There you go. It's bad enough coming in and trying to, you know, just he's got to hit the ground running and win games. And let alone he's now facing supposedly winning over a squad that were behind Adkins and winning over the fans. That makes it even doubly difficult, but especially as they still are in that other great cliche, relegation dogfight. This is not the time to bring in a manager completely new into a new situation. If they'd have survived, if Adkins had survived and kept them up, and then perhaps Cortese, because Cortese, if I'm led to believe, doesn't share Adkins' view of kind of safety first. He wants Southampton to push on and be really progressive and become that sort of top 10, top 4 team. And perhaps
I think he was told, or he was under the impression, that they would play a certain type of football and they bought players, accordingly.
For a lot of money.
Yeah. You can say they're good, they're bad, but I mean, you know, if you have Lambert, Rodriguez, and Gaston Ramirez, those are three very attacking players. Most teams that are in the patented Clive Petty relegation dogfight generally don't have three attackers like that. Somebody has to defend Cortese here. So, Julian, what do you make of Clive's argument that, you know, the timing does matter, because Cortese would have said that, well, you know, in November, Pochettino wasn't available.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a big fan of Pochettino to start with. He's a PhD legend, so I'm really looking forward to see.
Am I right in thinking he once coached the women's team at Espanyol as well?
Yeah.
So he's a progressive guy as well.
Yeah, and he was assistant, to Luis Fernandez and you know, things like that. So I love the guy anyway, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what we can do in the Premier League. But I mean, it's a very interesting one. They kept him where things were wrong, and they sack Adkins where things were better. But I think, you know, there are probably things that we don't know. You know, they might never got on, Cortese and Adkins. And I think if my boss at some point and me keep arguing all the time, you know, about a lot of things at work, then maybe at some point we'll go our own way. And probably it's the same with you. If the day Tony Evans will hate you, you might never work for the Times ever again. But you know what I mean? It's like it's more than just losing 2 in 12. It's as well how things go, behind the doors and things like that. And if they got to the point where they just didn't get on anymore about transfers, about the way the team was playing and everything, that's the time where you just let him go.
I mean, as far as I know, I don't know if Clive, if you have some special insight in this, I don't believe it was a case of a souring of a personal relationship.
I've not heard anything about a falling out that would suddenly think we've got to get this guy in.
But Gab, then how do you explain that Pochettino said in his press conference that he knows the players because he's been looking at the games for several weeks, which means that they've been telling him, oh, just wait a bit and you'll be appointed. So, like, what do you make of that?
Well, to take the first part about the souring of the, it wasn't a personal relationship thing, because Cortez, as you know, his background is in banking and consultancy and stuff like that. He's one of those guys who comes from the outside and thinks that the status quo in football and football people aren't very broad-minded and they just keep doing the same things over and over again, and he shakes things up. One of the reasons that he liked Adkins is because Adkins, of course, has a very non-traditional football background himself, right? And so they had very much a shared vision for a lot of the things that they were doing there, which is very different from Pardew, because Pardew's much more old school in his approach. And Adkins, as far as I know, you know, Adkins isn't the kind of, you know, he's not devious, he doesn't have a temper, he's not, you know, like, they got along. I think Cortez has simply put his financial hat on and his sort of consultant hat on and says, like, is this the best possible manager for Southampton? Or for the same money, can I bring in somebody who's better than him? So, I can bring somebody who's better. And I think Pochettino's better. And so I will bring him in and replace Adkins and take the long view that way, and people would just better deal with it. I think that was that's part of his logic. And the other part of the logic was I think he really did expect, as Clive said, the team to be much more attacking. You know, he said, we've spent our resources on a tab, what is it, like 20 million between Ramirez and Jay Rodriguez, right? And so, you know, if we were going to be more defensive, I would have invested in defenders. Does that match with your information, Clive, generally about his train of thought?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, and to be honest, I think they should have invested more in defenders, and especially in a sort of goalkeeping situation, which has kind of let them down a bit. There's a lot of talk about the sort of academy as well, as if Pochettino is going to be bringing more gear towards bringing youth through.
That's one big thing, because of course Southampton have a very good academy. They actually have two academies. That's how good they are.
But again, but the team is kind of feeling the benefit of that too. They've already got sort of, you know, Lallana's come through that way, Shaw's come through that way. So it wasn't as if Adkins was kind of failing in that respect either. I just think now it's just the timing of now when that is going to backfire against them. I hope it doesn't, because I kind of like the idea of Southampton, you know, stay in the Premier League. I think
really? You want another soft Southern club?
Yeah.
In the Premier
League? Yeah, got me exactly.
But you're so Northern.
But yeah, but I just think they've been judged rather harshly. I mean, they had when they started off with those 8 defeats in 10 games, as it were, I think it was 8 defeats in 10 games. But including those 10 games were, you know, United, City, Arsenal, Everton, and dare I say it, Spurs, you know. That was a tough start for a newly promoted team. And so perhaps now they're actually, you know, it's now that they've kind of hit their straps and found some sort of form after bouncing back from that, which makes the timing again seem very strange.
All right, let's turn our attention towards Africa and the Cup of Nations. And our colleague and podcast favorite, Rory K. Smith, is down there. Rory, the African Cup of Nations is I think in recent years we've sort of grown a little more accustomed to it, that sort of every couple of years, or in this case just 12 months later, our Januaries are interrupted and we can see a different sort of football in on television. What's exciting you about this time around, other than the fact that it's not held in a weirdo country run by a mad dictator?
Well, to be honest, I'm not sure that every South African would agree with you there. The thing that's great, I think, about the Cup of Nations is partly that it matters so much to the teams involved. Not that the World Cup and the European Championships and the Copa America don't matter, but I don't know. There's a kind of view in Europe, I think, that international football is kind of irrelevant for most of the year, and we're not that bothered. But you speak to the players here, and often it's for quite tragic reasons, because you know the countries that they're from are either quite poor, or in the cases of sort of Mali and Congo are sort of riddled with strife and conflict. It's a real sort of statement of nationhood, I think, for the players to be here representing their countries. You get these great stories like Niger and Ethiopia and Cape Verde, who's got a population of 500,000, and yet they look sort of incredibly well organised and are really punching above their weight. Even their FIFA ranking pays testament to that. You get this different clash of styles from West Africa, from East Africa, from North Africa and the Arab countries. South Africa has a really sort of distinct style of play. And I think that's something that's been lost in Europe as well, that everyone kind of looks the same. Even, I know Spain have kind of got this different philosophy, but it's more of a tweak to the way that everybody plays football rather than something completely different. Whereas in Africa, there is this real clash of styles, and that's really it's interesting to watch.
Now, we're only 2 days into the Cup of Nations, so I'm not really going to ask you about, you know, the favourites, runners and riders and all that stuff. I'm going to ask you actually about something else. That you wrote a great piece about South Africa and football and basically some of the elements about explaining why, as a nation, South Africa really aren't punching their weight, because, you know, they have better infrastructure than anybody really in Africa, with a possible exception of Egypt and Morocco and Tunisia. They have a large population that loves football. They've got a whole bunch of it's an immigrant country, so they've got a whole bunch of influences from around the world, and yet they seem to have, and while they've produced some great players in the past, they seem to have sort of this endemic difficulty to compete with the likes of Ghana and Nigeria and Cameroon and Egypt and whatnot.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating subject, South African football, because I spoke to Neil Tovey, who was the captain in 96 when they won the Cup of Nations, when it was last held here, and he said that they felt at that time that was the kind of, the stage was set, and South Africa would go on to become certainly the dominant African nation, you know, be up there, or at least be up there with kind of Nigeria and Cameroon and Ghana and Egypt. And it really hasn't happened. And if you look at their Cup of Nations performance, it's sliding with alarming regularity. So they win it in 96, it's the final in 98, semis in 2000, right down to not qualifying in 2012, and they're only in this because they're hosts, and they're only hosts because of what happened in Libya with Colonel Gaddafi. So it's a country whose footballing performance is getting worse, and the explanation for that I've heard sort of varies from, there's a stylistic problem in that the game developed under apartheid, obviously largely in black communities, and it wasn't exposed to the rest of the world, so it remained quite sort of rooted in the individualism that maybe we would have seen in Europe in, I guess, the 1920s and 1930s, to be perfectly honest. Then there's another issue, which is that the PSL, the league here, is rich compared to all the other African leagues, so it tempts players from across Africa. Each team's allowed 5 foreign players, but they all tend to be first-team players, which obviously limits the pool, and it's probably quite familiar to people in England. But the other thing, and this is something that I think about England as well, that's really interesting, is that South African players don't go abroad, and I think that's key to international success, and I realise that Spain are a massive exception to that rule, but South African, the majority of the squad, especially now Pienaar's retired, are based in South Africa, whereas if you look at the Ivory Coast or Ghana, a lot of their players might not be playing in the best European leagues, but they're all playing in Europe, and I think that lends itself maybe to an increased professionalism, greater tactical nuance, and maybe a little bit more humility as well, because the player, Sifiwe Tshabalala, who's kind of the left winger, massively overrated left winger of the South African side, is a huge star here. But in European terms, he'd maybe get into a championship team, that sort of level. And I think that there's a disconnect between expectation and reality among the fans, and that puts more pressure on the team. So it's a really complicated situation, and a lot of it, as I wrote this morning, is kind of related to what's happening in England with the travails of England's national team, admittedly at a much higher level.
Fascinating stuff, Rory. Enjoy your time down there. Please bring Skinner and myself some biltong when you return, and we'll catch up with you soon. All right, time now for some quick hits. So much for those who doubted the wisdom of signing Daniel Sturridge, eh? Liverpool stomp all over Norwich, 5-0, and are now just 7 points off a Champions League spot. I know, saying just 7 sounds silly, but come on, there's enough Liverpool supporters here, although there's none in the room right now, which is pretty cool. Clive, it's crazy to even think about Tony Evans back in the Champions League, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I don't even want to think about it, because if they do, that means, of course, that somehow Spurs have screwed it up again. So, no. Liverpool, if they can carry on playing Norwich every week, they will do fine. Yeah, they seem to be able to stomp all over them quite easily. It's kind of the teams above them that Liverpool have a problem with, and until they start winning and showing that they can do something in those big games, then that's going to be their downfall, I think.
Villa grab a point against West Brom as Charles Nzogbia is handed what our Peter Lansley called a luxury role behind the strikers. Julian, what do you make of this? And can he be the added value down the stretch for a team that threw all the youngsters in and now might go back to one or two veterans?
Well, it was about time, finally, that, you know, he showed all his talent, because I think he is a talented guy. The problem has been his attitude for a long time, but hopefully that could finally be, you know, the real break that he was looking for, and it could be that added value, you know, for Villa, because I think he's got one of the best left foot in the country, for sure.
But playing as a one behind a two, anybody else in the Premier League do that? You don't really see that much.
No, yeah, exactly. I mean, Rooney played like that at Newcastle for United, but didn't do that much often. And I think that's a role that suits Enzo Biafine fine.
Newcastle lose at home to Reading. They've won just twice since October. Clive, your contract isn't looking quite so clever now, is it?
Yeah, Newcastle, they really don't know how to do stability very well, do they? I mean, perhaps everyone talks about last season and how, what did they finish? Was it sixth or seventh? Or fifth, wasn't it, actually?
Fifth.
Perhaps that really was just a freak season. And although they're not proper sort of relegation candidates, this is about their level. You know, the squad really isn't strong enough to support what they did last season. And now they're getting shown up, I think. They're struggling. They're in a very bad time at the moment, and they surely need a lift now. Was it Aston Villa the next league game? I mean, that's suddenly a must-win game, and followed by Chelsea and Spurs, I think. So they're really up against it.
But Yoann Cabaye's back, so everything's going to be fine. QPR have 5 points from the last three games, Julian. Is this the Redknapp effect? And also, Loic Remy scores on his debut after stinking it up in his last few months at Marseille. Is it a smart signing, or did he just start scoring because he moved to a weaker league?
I don't know. I've kept telling everybody how rubbish he'd been so far this season, and he scores after 14 minutes on his debut. So it was so typical. But I mean, good for him and good for QPR, because they play so deep that he will have a lot of more chances like that to play with Tarbat if Tarbat stays behind him. I think there is a Harry effect, definitely. I'm not sure it will last long, because they should have been hammered by West Ham at the weekend, and they were not, so they're still riding their luck a bit. But, you know, at least there's hope.
City beat Fulham 2-0, but from the manager's perspective, the biggest news of the week may well be that he won't be shoved out the door to make way for Pep Guardiola. Clive, what percentage chance that Mancini sticks around next season?
City, what? I mean, they're second. He may well waltz off with the title again this season. He may well win something. It's a bit much to be writing a guy out of a job when you're sitting second in the table and I don't know, still with a chance of an FA Cup victory, perhaps. But I think Mancini will be relieved that one of the main bugbears of his life is out the way. But he's still got those two ex-Barcelona guys making plans behind him in Bagheristan and Soriano. So perhaps his position isn't cemented, but he'll be feeling a lot easier, I think.
Mancini, relieved, not released. Julian, we've asked Clive for chances and percentages. Let's ask you, too. Percentage chance that Michael Laudrup is still there next season, given the job he's been doing?
I think he will be there next season, but probably not further than that, because I think he's a bright manager. I would love to see him at Arsenal, for example. I think he's ready for a much bigger club after Getafe and Swansea, where he did really well considering the squads and the size of the clubs. But I really think he's ready for much bigger and much better, and I hope he gets the opportunity.
One for you, Gab. The Wesley Sneijder saga is finally over. Why did he go to Galatasaray?
He ultimately went to Galatasaray because they really, really, really wanted him. He is taking a very small pay cut, and he's getting a longer contract. He could have had a similar deal at Inter, but I think ultimately became clear to him that he wasn't wanted there. I'm not surprised that he didn't go to Liverpool, because I don't know how real Liverpool's interest really was, because I think, you know, he fit Liverpool like a bicycle fits a school of fish. But that said, it does seem weird that a player of his talent is playing in Turkey, but I think it also shows a little bit the landscape in European football is shifting a little. And by the way, he'll be paying 15.15% taxes over in Turkey. That's all we've got time for this week. It's been fun. Thanks to my guests. Come find us on Twitter to share your thoughts. Or, as so many of you do every week, you can email us at gamepodcast@thetimes.co.uk. You can go to thetimes.co.uk for all your news, your views, your web chats, blogs, and analysis. And, of course, you can follow us all on Twitter as well. Till next time. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.